Roger Martin is the Dean of the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and former director of the consulting firm Monitor. Roger is a frequent contributor to the Harvard Business Review, and he has a new book out, The Opposable Mind: How Successful Leaders Win Through Integrative Thinking. It's published by Harvard Business School Press and is available in good bookstores. Roger Martin, welcome to Take Five. Thanks for joining us here on the third floor.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Roger, I guess we should start with a simple question from the title. What is an opposable mind, and when is it handy to have?
Well, I'd say it's handy to have any time you are facing a situation where there doesn't seem to be any good answer immediately presenting itself to you. And an opposable mind is one that can take two or more opposing ideas, let's just say two for sake of simplicity, and instead of accepting one or the other, forge a better answer that combines the best of the two into a new answer.
Can you give us an example? I mean, not everyone's a business person out there listening to us, but give us an example, maybe from the book, of when this has been helpful to some of the CEOs you interviewed.
Sure. Well, let's take Bob Young, who is the co-founder of Red Hat Software, the dominant supplier of Linux software in the world. He faced in the mid-80s what seemed to be two models of software. One was the proprietary model. Microsoft spent a lot on R&D, produced patented software, sell it for big bucks, versus the emerging free software market, where it wasn't really actually free. It was selling for 10 or 15 bucks shrink-wrapped versions of Linux software. What he realized is that the free software market business was one that you're never going to make any money because anybody could do it, and at 10 or 15 bucks a pop, it wasn't going to make any money. He couldn't do the proprietary software business because that meant investing billions of dollars in R&D. And instead of saying, I have to either be proprietary or free, he said, well, what's a better way to do this? And came up with the notion of we will give away software completely free on the internet. Red Hat.
That's radical.
And that is radical. And by doing that, we'll become the dominant supplier of Linux as a solution. And then corporations will say, who's the dominant supplier here? Who do we have to do business with? And who can we have as our service provider? And we will actually sell services, not the software. And on the basis of that, he became a billionaire, and Red Hat became the dominant producer of Linux software in the world. So he didn't accept the two models that presented themselves, but he used aspects of the two because the proprietary software people made lots of money from servicing their software, and the free software model was one of getting distribution of that software out there, combined them, and had a home run.
What was the process for doing your research? You interviewed several dozen CEOs?
Over 50 highly successful folks. So what I wanted to do is make sure that they had exemplary success so that nobody could say, oh, no, that's not really successful. And I interviewed them, typically in front of a class of students. I would bring them in and interview them about how they thought. Because I've always believed that it is slightly problematic to ask these successful people, well, what did you do? And then say, well, you should do what these people did. Because what they did was so context specific to their time, their place, the company, the organization. And instead, I wanted to swim upstream one and ask them, well, what was the thinking that led to the action?
Some of the names on your interview list are very impressive. Michael Lee Chin, Bob Young, you've mentioned, Jack Welch of GE, Meg Whitman of eBay, CEO of eBay, Pierce Handling here in Toronto, and Isidore Sharp of the Four Seasons chain and Four Seasons fame. Can you tell us a little bit? That's a very interesting story, how he got started and how he used integrative thinking to kickstart, I guess, the Four Seasons.
Absolutely. He looked at a world that had two successful models of in the hotel and lodging business. The small motel model, and that actually was his first, Four Seasons Motor Inn, 125 rooms on Jarvis Street. Lots of an intimate, friendly environment, a place that people loved to come and stay, but very few amenities because you can't afford many amenities like teleconferencing facilities, swimming pools, etc., with only 125 rooms. The other model was the 750-room-plus convention hotel, lots and lots of amenities, but fairly cold and impersonal places. That was his third hotel, which is the Four Seasons Sheraton. It's now the Sheraton, but it was a joint venture with Four Seasons. He looked at those models and said, boy, I like the ability to afford the amenities of the bigger hotel, but I hate the coldness and impersonality of it. I love the intimacy of the small one, but no amenities. And instead of saying, well, I just have to choose, he said, what would be a better model? And the better model for him ended up being the medium-sized, uber-luxury hotel that had such highly differentiated service that even at a smaller scale than people thought was possible, his are in the 225 to 350 room set, because he charged such a high price premium, he could afford all the amenities for his customers and give them a more intimate feeling experience. And that was his Inn on the Park in London, his breakthrough hotel that he's now replicated around the world. And it's the largest, most successful luxury hotel chain in the world, based here in Canada, which is great.
A lot of your stories are based here in Canada. And I found it, even if you're not a business person, I found this an interesting business read, because these little snapshots of people's business situations. Two people that I found interesting was A.G. Laffley of Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. And Michael Lee Chin. But both of them caught my eye for one reason, is that A.G. Laffley described his bet on compact detergent, which I guess might have been perceived by the market as poor value, having mm-hmm. getting less bang for your buck,
yeah,
basically.
It looks like a littler package, yeah.
And he describes it, though, as a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. And Michael Lee Chin, well, he found himself in a tough situation and bet the bank on one business decision. Both of those, I mean, if you bet the bank and it works out, you're a genius. But it sounds like integrative thinking might be high risk. Can you describe briefly those two decisions and why an investor, for instance, should be betting his RSP dollars on someone who's making that kind of a high risk decision? Or is it high risk?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, I do think that both of those integrative thinkers and others did emphasize to me when I interviewed them that these weren't sure things. And I think that's, in fact, the case. When you come up with a brand new model, Izzy Sharp coming up with a brand new model, it may be wrong. What I would say about them is, though, that even though AG said it was a crapshoot and perhaps his as he said it, it was a fireable offense if he got it wrong. He used that word. It was very funny. It wasn't betting the company, and it was enough of a bite-sized chunk of something to do that if it would have been wrong, I think he'd have lived to actually fight another day. I think it was a fireable offense, but he probably wouldn't have gotten fired because the thinking was sensible behind it. And this is what I found of all of them. Izzy, for example, experimented with one hotel in this model and then worked. They're not silly about it. They come up with a model and then figure out a way to make it happen. In the case of Michael Lee Chin, I think his back was enough against the wall that he had to do something that was
what did
bet
he do?
The company. What did he do? Well, he was in a situation where because he had a buy and hold strategy, he had very few stocks in his mutual funds, 10 to 15 versus the usual 150 to 200. And that meant that if one of those stocks or several of those stocks simultaneously started to do badly, which they were doing as the internet bubble was upon us, and everybody was saying, I want to get into the internet, and he was saying, that's a bad idea. He turned out to be right, that if he had to start selling stocks to meet the redemptions, people asking for their money back, that would affect the prices of his stocks, and he'd go into a downward spiral. So instead, he bet big on buying one of the stocks in his portfolio, and that kind of reversed the downward spiral, turned it upward. That was probably a dangerous move, but it was a way out.
For non-business types, mm-hmm. How can everyone apply integrative thinking in their everyday life, or where have you seen integrative thinking being useful outside of the business world?
Well, I think it's equally applicable, and in fact, in the book, I in some sense attempt to show that by featuring prominently a couple of people who are not in the world of business. Teddy Bletcher, who created the first largely free university in South Africa for the disadvantaged blacks who could otherwise not go to university. I think everybody has the choice in whatever they do when they're faced with what they think of as a rock and a hard place decision, devil in the deep blue sea kind of decision, to rather than say, I am sure those are the only two answers and I have to choose one of the bad ones, to say, I should sit back and ask this question, is there another model that's better than those two? We tend to be too accepting of the prevailing models out there. And I see that with students. I see that with friends. They assume in some sense that there is not room for creativity, and there always is.
But as a layperson, I don't have to get up every morning and think of another way to brush my teeth or tie my shoes. I presume there are specific instances when integrative thinking is applied. Otherwise, it could be an exhausting exercise.
That's right. What I would say you need integrative thinking for is in situations where you do not have now presenting you a good alternative. So tying your shoes, no problem. You figured out how to tie them, and it works just fine for you. Brushing your teeth works just fine for you. But if you say, I either have to accept my coworker treats me badly, and I either have to accept that and live with being treated badly, or confront him or her and probably get fired. Right? Well, no, probably not. There's probably a better answer than those two, just suffer silently or get in a big row. And that would be a situation where I'd say, go beyond those two models. But only when you're faced with that sort of situation do you need to engage your opposable mind.
So you aren't sending your newly minted MBAs out into the world rattling their opposable mind in the mailroom of Philip Morris every morning, I presume.
Well, hopefully not Philip Morris. But I think what I'm attempting to teach them is to take a stance in the world. So to be in the world in a way that says, when faced with what seems to be a choice between the lesser of two evils, no good answer, don't accept the choices. Just don't. That's the time when you put your thinking cap on, because if you do, you've got a good chance of coming up with an answer that's better.
And yet, it's proven difficult for people to use their opposable mind or to think integratively. You just use an example of even your students who struggle with this concept to think outside of their boxes. Why do we have such a difficult time thinking like all these successful CEOs?
Well, I think one of the problems is with the educational system that we have created in the world, which I think is too much focused on teaching you the right answer. And for you to come up with the right answer to a question. So you take a history course and you then write an exam where you have to come up with the right analysis. I don't think that trains your opposable mind, right? That trains you to faithfully regurgitate or set out an existing model. And so people aren't as confident as they should be in the creation of new models. And that I think I'd lay at the feet of the educational system. I would rather have every course you take say, here's one way of looking at it, and here's the theory behind it, here's the people who've wrote about this, and here's another way of thinking about it. And you know what? They're not compatible with one another. Now what do you do? What would you do in the face of that? And I think if students practiced that, they would be more inclined to use their opposable mind readily. They'd say when they find a situation like that out in the real world, they'll say, oh, I know this, right? I know what you do here. You think some more. Whereas now I think they go out into the world and when they find themselves in that situation, they say, oh my God, this makes me nervous. Which of these is the right answer? No, it's not which of these is the right answer. It's how can I create a better answer? I want to have them feel comfortable doing that.
Roger, one of your CEOs mentions the trial and error aspect of their integrative thinking. And one of your CEOs, Victoria Hale, says, I just know, meaning I just know when I've got the right solution. But how does an integrative thinking CEO know that their third way is the right way. Some of them might have cash flow constraints that don't allow them the time, the luxury to sit and just think about alternatives.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although when you pose it that way, you sort of think about it. If you don't have the luxury of being able to think and you're facing kind of a rock and a hard place decision, what's the better alternative to integrative thinking, right? Just choosing one of the crummy alternatives right now. You know, I think it's often worth the time to do a little bit more thinking. I think all of these integrative thinkers recognize the urgency of the situation. So Michael Lee Chin had between 5 o'clock one afternoon and 9 o'clock the next morning to do it. I think the question is just how you think at the time, not how much time you take to think. His thinking was not rock, hard place, which it's no, something is telling me that if I choose one of these or the other, I will never accomplish my goals. So that's a trigger to say I have to think harder, even if I'm thinking quickly and acting decisively.
But one of your six elements of stance is having the time to look for that new alternative model.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think they what they do is they say to themselves, I have to know it's a good solution and have this sense of it's a good enough solution. That having been said, I would just say there are times when, in the case of Michael Lee Chin, that was going to be less than a day. But I'd rather have him, if he has a day, I'd rather have him think 23 hours and 59 minutes searching for the better answer than thinking 8 hours and say, well, that's as good as it's going to get. So I just say, I think you're right. I want them to take the time. And Victoria Hale was lovely. Institute of One World Health founder, helped provide the world with a cure for black fever. Is going to save 500,000 poor, disadvantaged people in the world per year. She just said, well, sometimes I just have to sit and roll these things around in my mind. And that's more the attitude. It's not as though that's going to take months, but this idea of I will give myself a chance to roll around these existing models, potential new ideas before I lock and load.
Sam Zell is a real estate developer, described as a real estate magnate. And,
yes.
And he talks about trying to shut out the noise of conventional wisdom because, quote, it may not always be wrong, but it's rarely profitable. Why
That's a good quote.
Why is the opposable mind different than just opportunism or contrarian thinking going against the field?
Well, I think it's different than contrarian thinking in that it's not as reflexive. The only thing I don't like about the Sam Zell quote, and I don't think it's actually he's actually being completely honest about what he does, is that there's a reflexive contrarianism. It's whatever you say, Peter, I'm going to say the opposite. You say X, I'm going to say not X. Integrative thinkers don't do that. What they're more inclined to do is say there's an X and a Y, and I'm not going to accept the conventional wisdom that those are the only two ways to do something. They sort of have this fundamental optimism, right, that says there's always going to be a better way, right? Even the best model that we come up with, even if you're Sir Isaac Newton and you come up with a really good model for how physics works, the laws of physics, it may not be entirely perfect, and it is worth searching for that better model. So I like that better than sort of reflexive contrarianism. But I do like the aspect of contrarianism that says, I don't trust that the current dominant model is as right as it could possibly be, and there's nothing better. That attitude, I think, is a very positive one.
Roger, I presume you have to practice what you preach. Mm-hmm. Can you take us to the Rotman School of Management and tell us what maybe unpalatable or unappealing choices you've faced over the years you've been there, and how have you applied this thinking process to your work there?
Sure, and in a bunch of ways. I guess I'll give you one, which is when I arrived at the Rotman School, I was not an academic, and so I needed to learn lots, and people gave me lots and lots of advice. And one piece of advice they gave me is, you have to choose, Roger, to either make this a teaching-oriented or a research-oriented school, because you can't have both. If you're teaching oriented, you won't get good research, because researchers don't want to spend their time teaching. And if you become research oriented, you won't have very good teaching. Or if you become teaching oriented, you won't get very good research. So those two things are conflicting with one another, right? And I'm thinking sort of, well, that's a kind of a miserable choice. I either have a place where the students kind of love it because they're being taught well, but by people who aren't very good, you know, kind of professors otherwise, and we have no research reputation, or I have a bunch of people who are fantastic researchers and the students feel completely alienated. Mm. But I'm told, that's it, Roger. It's one or the other. So I said...
So,
I
exactly.
Yeah, so I thought to myself and said, well, let's try this. Wouldn't it be true that students would love to be taught by somebody who's tremendously excited about what they're teaching? And what are the researchers most excited about? They're most excited about their research. And what if you told them, you don't have to teach other stuff than what you're researching? In fact, you need to teach. I want you to teach your absolute research passion. Well, then you get these researchers who will come to class absolutely passionate about about what they're teaching, because it's what they're working on now. You'll have students learning how to be a scientist in the world, because they're learning from somebody who's teaching them what they're working on now, researching. You'll get the newest stuff in the world, stuff that other people wouldn't know, and you'll have happy students and happy professors. And instead of having kind of people being either great researchers and terrible teachers, or great teachers and terrible researchers, you'll have people who get from the students great teaching ratings and evaluations, and they'll be great researchers. I did a little analysis 5 years after instituting that policy, and we have an incredibly powerful positive correlation between teaching and research. So the whole notion that it's one or the other is just false, and we're proving it utterly.
Has this been putting Rotman on the map?
It's helped. It certainly helps. Students love the professors. The professors love to come here because they can teach their research. And it has these other positive impacts, right? People say, well, what if the research isn't kind of stuff that's at all of interest to students? Well, it's if the professor doesn't have to teach his or her research, he or she can get away with that, because nobody will say, this isn't interesting at all. If they're actually having to teach it, the students help explain to them why what they're doing isn't terribly valuable, and they'll modify their research. So I think it's gotten us better research than we would otherwise, better, more relevant research than we would otherwise, and it's gotten students a better educational experience than they would have otherwise. And I think that's integrative thinking.
Roger Martin is the dean of the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and the author of a new book, The Opposable Mind. Roger, thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for all the great questions.